I need to start with a joke, which I almost never do because I'm not a guy. And usually I just plunge right into my organized outline like the Immaculate Heart Sisters in Philly taught me. But I felt that this topic, revealing the heart of God, is so huge and so much beyond my abilities that I needed to open with this fabulous joke. So you could understand the genuine humility with which I come at this topic. So a moth goes to a doctor. And he goes in and he says, "Doctor, I'm having a crisis. I am afraid of living. I am terrified of each day. When I look in the eyes of my children, Alexandra and Ivanova, I know that they can see the smallness and the desperation in my eyes, and they do not respect me. And my wife, Oksana, she does not love me anymore. She can see that I am afraid to live. How can I support this woman if I am afraid to live? And at my office, my boss, Vladimir, he knows that I think I am nothing but a small cog in a wheel. And I am incapable of anything innovative and new." And the doctor just goes, "Wow, you are really having an existential crisis." And he goes, "But I'm confused. Why did you come to see me? I'm a podiatrist." And the moth says to him, "Oh, well, your light was on." So I had that reaction myself when I was asked to do a talk with this topic, because I feel that I am not insightful or spiritually advanced. But my light is on that says that when the church comes calling, in particular sisters, so many of whom have gifted me in my lifetime and so many whom I love in a very personal and long-term fashion, that my light is always on for sisters. And so I said, "Okay, I'll try, and I'll take this in the sort of vocational Holy Spirit intention with which it was offered." But that's really my perspective. I'm a podiatrist, and all of you really need a psychiatrist. So, my heading, I at least narrowed it to revealing the heart of God in the family and the academy, which is at least where I felt I had the slightest bit of street cred, right? In the two things that I've been married for 31 years, I have three children, 21, 19, 16. I've miscarried four children in my life. We have been through, you know, lots of the ordinary things that families go through. Recently I've lost my sister, and my parents have died. So I have family experience. And then in the academy, I've been a lawyer for 31 years, but I've been a professor for 16 of those. And so I have got some thoughts in that arena. Here is how I intend to approach it. Okay, I'm standing in the light there. I want to talk about sort of my method, to the extent that I could figure out what it was. What my method and my qualifications for trying to reveal Christ, and in my case also, because of the positions I've had, to reveal the church. Because I have always been seen in the eyes of the world as a stand-in for a woman in the church in a certain way. Whether I put myself forward or not, as soon as I worked for the U.S. bishops as an attorney and then for 10 years in public presentations for them, when they see me, they also are judging the church. It reminds me once, I remember having breakfast with Cardinal Bernardino, and he didn't eat a bite. And while we were sitting, people kept coming to talk to him. And I said, "Oh, you're never going to get to eat anything." And he goes, "You don't think I ever eat at any of these, do you?" He said, "I eat before I ever walk out the door, because if I don't say hello and speak to whoever says hello to me, then the whole church can go to hell as far as they're concerned." And I thought, yeah, and that, not at that level, but in a similar way, I have been out in the world as someone who gets judged, and the church is being judged in a similar vein. So I wanted to talk about my vantage point, how I... the vantage point from which I try and do this. The first thing is to say that in my spiritual life, I refer to myself as workmanlike. I am not a smells and bells prayer. I have had two or three occasions in my life where I have felt that God has made it clear to me that I was to do one thing or another. Very few of those. I took great consolation from Mother Teresa's letters in this vein about her spiritual dryness, and also her famous prayer, which was so illuminated for us by her letters, "Do it anyway." And that has been my vantage point. I have a regular prayer life, I would say constant even. Father Paul Scalia is writing a book, and he asked me to do a piece of it on prayer. And I said, you know, I mean, either this is a joke or God is working through you, because I really am not going to inspire too many people. I'm always working at it. And watching somebody work is not very interesting. But I'll write it for you. On the other hand, the method that I have adopted in my life, which is now, I jokingly say that I'm far enough along that I'm beginning to take a look at that arc of history everybody's always talking about, right? That I can, you can see things in your 50s. The 50s are a blessing from that point. I hope they can, you know, later ages continue to be like them in that regard, where I can see that my method, which is to have been convicted, I know that sounds very evangelical, but to have been convicted before the age of 10 that the church was a member of my family, that somehow I had a special responsibility for her. And it was, I had Immaculate Heart of Mary nuns in Philly. I also had a lot of friendships with Sisters of St. Joseph. And they had that, it was very easy to be in that conversation with them because the church was their family as well. And so what I knew that. And when in law school I was just about to leap into a major career with a big corporate law firm, which I did for 3 years, each of my friends, we wrote a letter saying what we would like to be doing in 10 years and what we would be doing in 10 years. And I wrote, in 10 years from graduation, I will be golden handcuffed to a large law firm and drive a great car. And in 10 years, I would prefer to be teaching religion or law and religion. Well, it took me 15 years to get there. Not bad in considering life. But I knew that even though I didn't know exactly where I was going, my method has always been to ask God for help and then to leap somewhere in the direction of a vocation to the church where I have some tiny intuitions or insights that I'm supposed to go. Or I have had the benefit of guidance of a lot of very holy people who have said to me, you know, you really ought to. And I'll say, no. And then a year, 2 years later, it proved out that they had insight. So I've begun, after my 20s, I began to listen to holy people as guides more and go in that direction. And then what happened was I looked back on what I had done after leaping, and it turned out that I was more useful in than I could have been by a logical measure. In other words, I put X in the machine, but the machine spilled out, you know, X plus Y plus Z. And therefore, I began to understand that God's method with me, it seemed, for my being able to contribute wherever I was not to question the thing to death or logical it out in advance, but to leap and then to look back and learn. And to see what happened, and let that direct my vocation. So I have wanted to be, and this may resonate with many of you. I remember my high school biology teacher, Sister Helen Louise, and her name will never leave me because my name's Helen and my deceased sister is Louise. And Sister Helen Louise, who taught me bio, was also a friend, and I would chat with her in her office hours, and she said to me, I can't believe I'm stuck teaching bio. I love English literature more than I can tell you, but they needed a bio teacher. And I always thought, oh, they do that? And now, many years into my world, I am in an academy where all benefits and admiration come from being a great intellect and from writing things that are hard for other people to understand, but generally credit, you know, consensus acclaimed as genius, somehow. And yet, what I keep getting asked to do, for the church is communications. So I've been invited to several meetings at the Holy See where I think, you know, the envelope comes, I know there's a conference coming, and I think, oh, this is going to be great. I will contribute my scholarship on, you know, family law or First Amendment, freedom of religion. And I open it up, and the slot is how to communicate these things, not the logic of them, not the theology of them, not some genius idea, but ways to take those things and express them to the world. And after I have my initial, you know, Edward Monk scream moment, I have come to accept that this is where I have been called. And that's that. So I now want to talk about the issues that I've been called on. And I know many of you, not all of you, work on these issues, but these are the issues where I have been, and there's no doubt, it was a series of events, but explicitly called to explain our faith, our church, and where church meets world, what the Catholic Church has to offer to neuralgic moral issues in the world. And also what I have been asked to contribute on the question, who are we as Christians? We had a joke. I worked for 10 years in the U.S. Bishop's Pro-Life Office, and we knew we had 10 women and one guy. And when he'd come in the morning, we're like, tell us our hair looks nice. Okay, good. You can go into your office now. I mean, it was when do you get that? It's a bishop's conference, 10 women and one guy. We took advantage of it. And we had a joke among the women because every time we left that building, we knew we were being judged as the Catholic Church's pro-life women. And we were all lay women and still are. And I would say, no, actually one is a sister now. And I would say to the women, remember, girls, bad hair is bad for the movement. That was our joke. That if we're going to be judged in every way, then one of you have to leap over this first hurdle, which is, I'm a 19-year-old girl, do I even want to listen to you? And part of it had to be, make your looks not a factor. At least don't let them be distracting to them from us. So it was bad hair was bad for the movement. That was one of our mantras in that office. So the issues on which I was called, and it was clear that God was calling, I got to the U.S. Bishops' Conference. I had come from being an attorney at this large firm. And I'm told the U.S. bishops are being sued, this is in the 1980s in a lawsuit, by like June 30, if we don't produce the documents the court has required, we will be charged $100,000 per day for failure to turn over these documents. You've got 4 weeks. And I had to go through every paper in the pro-life office and read it. And the question was, did any of them show that the bishops had violated their 501c3 tax-exempt status and said yes? You know, said something favorable about a candidate or a party was the question, versus just teaching about the moral issue. So I sat and I read every paper in the pro-life office night and day for those weeks. I didn't have any kids yet. We were just married. Well, actually, we were married, but we had lived in separate states for 3 years. So it was the first time we had lived in the same house in our fourth year of marriage. And I read them, and I was blown away by the rationality and the genius of the pro-life position and the smallness and the illogical quality of the argument on the other side. So I worked on that, and then it might have been a year later, I got called into the general counsel's office himself, and he said, are you pro-life? And I said, yeah, I'm pro-life. And he goes, well, we need to start filing a series of briefs in the U.S. Supreme Court. Do you want to do that for us? It'd be kind of cool to have a woman writing the U.S. Church's pro-life briefs. So I wrote the bishop's Supreme Court documents on abortion, euthanasia, then I did anti-capital punishment, then I did First Amendment, freedom of religion stuff. And it became known that there was a woman writing this stuff for the church. And at one point I was asked to address all the state Catholic conference directors and all the diocesan pro-life directors at a meeting in Washington. And when I was finished, they all stood up and started shouting something to the equivalent of, hire her. Why aren't you working in the pro-life office? We need a woman. We need a woman. So shortly thereafter, Cardinal O'Connor got the Knights of Columbus to fund this big pro-life program. I was asked to take it over, and I said no for a year because I did not want to be in the press. I was finishing, I thought, my PhD in systematic theology, which I loved. And in one of the only smells and bells experiences in my whole life, I was at Mass, and I was given to understand that I would take the job and everything else would take care of itself. And I didn't want it. And I took it the next morning, Cardinal O'Connor. I went in and told communications. They called the cardinal. They put me on a train in an hour, sent me up to His Eminence. He hired me at 2, and I was working the next day because he said we didn't have any time to waste. For those of you who knew Cardinal O'Connor, that was par for the course, okay? So the issues where I work are a denial of a very simple truth about the value of human life, that this is human life, and that obviously in the face of it, killing is the wrong response. A tougher issue today that I work on is the question of the value of man and woman in relationship, the value of sex being attached to children, the value of a permanent commitment in the family. After Cardinal Mahoney, who was my chairman for a while, sent me for a year to talk to post-aborted women, pretty much every couple of days I was talking with post-aborted women, I realized I needed to get out of the abortion issue as just by itself. And I had done it for 10 years. I was almost 40. In my book, that meant I was too old to be listened to by all of these teenagers I was talking to. And then I handed it over to a much more attractive blonde woman and moved into the academy where I could address the family. Everything these post-aborted women told me about, their misconceptions about mother, father, sex, parenting, them in a relationship, meaning of the good of men, the good of sex, relationships. And so it's been now, I'm going into my 16th year of dealing in the family. The contest, however, isn't just about sex and the family. It's about the woman herself. And of course, you all know this better than anybody. Is it safe even to admit there's two sexes and they have differences between them? Or is it always the case that if you say that there really are two, they do differ, that the woman will always be subjugated? Is that going to happen? We are in a situation where the entire sexual revolution is really just a story of opening everything up to women, and then everything opening up to women that used to be opened up to men, and then all those people that women used to care for and all those ways that women had of doing things are just left behind. Nothing ever said about them. Still not. Still nothing ever said about them. I'm just checking my time here. They're in a really bad situation, women today. They are judged 100% by male standards, and nothing has been done to ease it up for them. And what's more, what used to be considered a problem, that is uncommitted sexual expression, now even the government at the federal and state level is holding it up as the centerpiece of women's freedom. Sexual expression divorced from children is actually being promoted by the government. That's a very powerful ally that Planned Parenthood has in the government to promote that. Women are a particular issue that I address myself to, not only because of what the sexual revolution was, but because women are the target of this whole abortion question. Women are also, if you will, in the law and economics of the sex and mating market, women are the seller and men are the buyers. And if we could just get women to stop selling because they think that they have to sell in order to even have the promise of any relationship at all, even a boyfriend for a short period at all, let alone a runway toward marriage, then we really need to help women think about these things, right? So these are the arenas that I work in. The process or techniques, routines, practices that have entered into my world, and I think anybody's world who would work intensely on these issues, as a result of saying, yes, God, I will work on the family, I will work on marriage, I will work on women, I will work on sex, in the arenas of the academy and the arenas of the family. The first thing is that one will always be in the middle of a hot argument. I remember when I was a full-out corporate litigator for the large firm for 3 years, and I pick up the phone, and it was either my job to yell at someone or have someone yell at me. I remember, you know, and you're getting paid for this very nicely. I remember saying to my husband, I don't want a job where I'm yelling all the time. So then, of course, I got into the abortion issue. Good. I seem to be drawn to controversial issues, and it must be something that God has in mind for me. But I have thought about, and very early, because when you're working for the church on this, you have to be a friend of the heart of God on this from the very beginning. So what have I learned about process when you are working on these issues in this arena? Number one, no matter what person is in front of me, you know, that Pope Benedict, the phrase that really, I sort of heard gears click into place, was Pope Benedict's Deus Caritas Est, giving every person that look of love they crave. That was, it just made eminent sense to me. And I also had had enough experience with people by that time that you know that that immediately changes the situation. You really can, it's like alchemy in a situation. So to acknowledge the person, to see them, especially if they're coming in loaded for bear on same-sex marriage or the abortion question, or cohabitation as being a fine substitute for marriage or premarital sex, et cetera, to see them as vulnerable, because they are. It's not a pity party, but they are vulnerable. Anyone who has bought into this has bought into a version of the human person that is that sees themselves more as a victim and has lived more as a victim. No ad hominem, obviously. I don't even have to say that. My preparation has to be huge. I say to people, and sometimes I think it is not meant as, it's not meant to be immodest on my part, and it's not meant to be perfectionist when I say it to others. You have to be, on the thing you are working on, the smartest person in the room. You really, preparation, you know that famous Etienne Gilson's Intelligence in the Service of Christ. Preparation, mastery, and spiritually getting yourself ready to be attacked, at least in my case, always. Getting yourself ready to handle people who will always be in an antagonistic situation with you. But I find I absolutely cannot be one percentage point off. If the sentence should begin with perhaps, or in most cases, or according to U.S. studies, but gee, I don't know about Canada. If it should be, you know, this was a qualitative study versus quantitative. This is an anecdote, but I think it's powerful. This is a sociological explanation, and it may not be all there is, but I think it will touch you as true in your own experience. All of those hedgers, all of those accuracies. In a way, it is giving to human beings what they owe. Everybody is owed the truth. And it is not, I mean, I made the mistake of telling this lovely bishop who's given some money to my Women Speak for Themselves training initiative, let me come to your diocese to do something for you and thank you. And he says, great, I'm having a rally on the Capitol steps. And I wrote back and went, no way, because I am not, I may be, in, you know, try to be inspirational, but I'm not a rally screamer. I need long sentences, I need subpoints. And there's room for that as long as it's truthful. But I find, for the long run in these, saying to people what is true and being honest about it, and facing the facts where they land, even if they're not always in our favor, but you'll be happy to know that where reason and revelation are concerned on the matters of marriage and the family, it works out quite well for us. The other thing in my case, because I'm dealing with the world as communicator, but I'm also dealing with the academy, is I must publish scholarship. And I want to publish scholarship. It's painful, as everybody here knows from your degrees, but I really like it. And it is valuable. And we know there aren't enough people doing the kind of scholarship that we need done. And so doing it ourselves and enabling students to do it is crucial. But for me, the question of the balance between the two. And I haven't found a satisfactory answer to that, except I try to answer need. So right now, I just, and if I ask all of you to say a prayer for me, it will be done. And I will ask you to say a prayer for me. I just lobbed a book proposal to the oldest publisher in the world, actually, the most significant university in this area, on a book about family law that I just want so badly. And I feel the need to do something in this on scholarship, because it's complete. There's this huge lacuna. And I can talk about it another time. It would take me too far off. But my method is to take an insight from Revelation and then take it to the data and to the legal scholarship without a footnote that references anything Christian. But I use the revelation to illuminate what I'm seeing in reason. And it directs me
what to think. So an example, for instance, would be the revelation of the person as gift, gifted giver, right? And I took that into all the literature about how young women were being trained about sex, and it turned out they're being trained to be self-maximizing monads. And it's not a shock that they're not touched by this, that they don't take it in, they don't react to it, they have more babies than before without being married, because they're not a gift anywhere else, and the government doesn't understand they're a gift, and the government keeps saying, come on, we're going to maximize you, we're going to get you a degree, we're going to give you money, we're going to get you out of this neighborhood, we're going to get you married someday, you can have all the sex you want, no babies, we're going to make it happen. You know, you're going to be alone and successful. And she's like, if that's the price of being successful, the heck with that, I don't want it. So, but where did that come from? It's my best article I've ever written. It all came from the Catholic thinking on person as gift. And so the process is, yes, to do scholarship when I feel that it's something's needed, but also, clearly, I'm called to translate this to the world in some ways. And so trying to figure out, you're going to be overly busy. You're going to have to give to too many people. But again, you're used to that. That seems to be the way of bringing Christ to the heart of the world, is being too busy. Okay, I'm trying to make this go, and it's giving me, oh, let me get a, there we go. So from this vantage point, where I am on the issues that I work on, my recommendations, as I said, in no particular order, because no order seemed to impose itself logically, regarding revealing the heart of God in these arenas. The first thing you see is people's desperation for community. If you show them that the heart of God is always a message about community, it's immediately attractive. One of the things Gus DeNoia, Archbishop, I worked with him when he was Father G, even Archbishop DeNoia, spoke about last night was the prophetic character of your communities as communities. Just even the fact that you live in community and you have each other till death do us part, that used to be associated with other relationships too. And people long for that. So one of the first things I think is I notice that whether in the family or in the academic setting, that if you reveal that who you are, what you are about, your faith, your church, is always also about relationship and community, it immediately attracts, all right? I will say, guys, I know Sister Mary Gabriel and the Sisters of Life, just I've interacted with them over the years, that people just seeing the sisters laugh together is better than 2 hours lesson on, you know, what the church thinks about human love. And I know the impression it's made on my children, still. My Julian, who says hello from his pointy-headed classes at UChicago on nihilism and skepticism, right? That made an indelible impression. That there is love here because there is community here, and there is community here because there is love here. So I stress in the arena of the family, people's longing for relationship and community. And the family as God's gift for doing that to us, as giving you your nearest neighbors right there. I say to children, you know, even this begins inside the family, who feel that they're not like the others. I say, you know, it's just a fact. This is not fanciful. This is not even overly spiritualized. This is not overly pietistic. God gave you to me in a very specific way, and to your sister, and to your brother, and to your father. He literally did this and put you here. That's how clear it is, right? And so within the family, this conversation about the church as community, our faith as communal. The necessity of this in the places where marriage is falling apart, particularly among the poor. I don't have to, you know the data on that. You know, the retreat from marriage among the working poor and the poor. It is also taking a particular kind of toll on women. Yes, it's taking a toll on men, but it seems to be taking a particular kind of toll on women whose sadness about not being married when they would like to be, whose worry about never having children when they're 33, 35, 38, when they would like to have children, is tragic. And I come in contact with it every week. So the particular told us they are longing to give to somebody and to be given to as a spouse, as parent. The I often think that the complete ignoring of all the data we have about what women really want is because nobody can really imagine that what women really want is to be givers and carers. Like, if you look at the data, like, women have been able to be anything for the last 40, 50 years, sort of like whatever. But they still say, I would prefer to give to my family first when I have one, and then my work. I'd love to work. Many women love it. Many women have cool jobs. Even those women whose jobs are not cool still like getting out of the house part-time, at least, and being with the community of other people, talking about other things. They certainly need the money to support their families. But if you ask women their preference, hands down, year in, year out, 50 years after the sexual revolution, they say they would prefer to give to family members first. Okay. In the student community, I find that being open about being a religious person, I mean, it's almost, I think they think I'm way holier than I am there because I'm so well known and in my school, which abides by academic freedom to the max and is proud of my work in religion. It's a state university, George Mason, and so incredibly walks the talk on academic freedom. Okay, and I am out and proud about being religious, and that attracts students of every religious denomination. So I have Muslims in my office who are, can't believe that I signed a brief, you know, on behalf of their mosque being able to be built in a town that had discriminatory zoning requirements. Or I have Orthodox Jewish students who want to come in to me and talk about sexual ethics, and they want to write a paper on the law and religion of that and are stunned about how much we have in common. I have evangelical students whose student groups I've headed. I've been head of at various times the Muslim women students group, the evangelical student group, and the Catholic student group. And my law and religion class regularly attracts Sikhs, Muslims, Jews, evangelicals, atheists, Catholics, you name it. And it is a wonderful experience. And so the being out about being a religious person and being confident and having fun with it, and knowing enough about your faith to speak about it intelligently, that's St. Paul, whom I adore, you know, to be able to give a reason for the hope that is in you, you form a community around you, and you make it safe for them to be religious, whoever they are in the United States, whoever they are. I noticed my evangelical brother and I were much closer when the world turned against Christians in a more unified way, against our sexual ethics, against our ethics on the family, as just, you know, we're all just narrow-minded bigots. We realized how much we had in common, and now that extends to all religions, very much so. The next point under recommendations here is fostering initiative, mediating institutions, so that large bureaucracies are not so prominent. I find that in order to make, you know, God and our faith and the church present in the world, we really need to foster these subsidiary communities. You know, subsidiarity always gets sort of the last word or the backhand. Oh, yeah, yeah, there's that leg of the Catholic social teaching school, too. But I have found that what is happening is that the government is becoming so overwhelming in its size and scope and power and finances that mediating institutions feel crushed. At George Mason, now we're a law and econ school, which makes us pretty skeptical of large malfunctioning bureaucracies. We just are. And there is a theory that grew up out of a Nobel Prize winning economist who teaches at my school, the public choice theory, that basically says the only reason anyone enters government is so that when they leave, they get a premium on their salary for, I worked at the White House. Public choice theory is scary and true. For the last 11 papers, I'd say, that we have had faculty from other schools come in and present to us is alarm over the size of the Federal Register, which is where the federal regulations are written. And obviously, the government's sticking its nose into the business of the Little Sisters is one of the most egregious and famous examples now, right? And of all of your institutions. It's very frightening. And the fact that the government can say, we don't think what burdens your conscience is a burden. I mean, that's what's really on the table in the Little Sisters case. So the administrative state growth is crushing initiative. It's entering into the family. As fewer people are getting married and having marital children, the government, you realize, is controlling almost every aspect of their family. When you divorce, or when you have out-of-wedlock children, the state says, well, you can see them Tuesdays from 4 to 8, and the other person sees them from da-da-da. Increasingly now, third parties are getting rights to have custody and visitation, so the step-parent will get this and this. There's even crazy family law professors who are arguing that caregivers who get very attached to children should have legal rights to have custody visitation at some times. Grandparents who have, by the way, taken a lot of the brunt of their children who couldn't afford to raise their own children are now filing for custody and visitation rights. Same-sex partners who went to the New Reproductive Technologies Clinic and held hands while the baby was created, while they're together, once they split, are now asserted. And the state is saying, okay, you're a father, you're a mother, okay, you're a second mother. You, grandparent, has this right. Step-parent has this right. Ex-step-parent, you still have right. You can all see them at this and this. You pay this. You pay that. 2 weeks vacation. Nope, sorry, not a day longer. And I'm sorry, it's your mother's birthday. We can't do that. You see, the state, the less the family, the more the state. And the same is now true in sort of every institution in American life just because of the government's size, power, money. And I'm not really highly political. I'm really not. I've been in both political parties and none, right? I don't have a lot of respect for either of them, frankly. Not the parties. Individual people, the parties. And I say this more because I'm just witnessing what is true, is that there is enormous interference in day-to-day lives and over our children, families, etc. I referred to the legacy of the French Revolution really because nobody today talks about the family or the relationship between the state and the citizen without raising the French Revolution. You know, its goal was, right, to wipe away the church, big goal, wipe away all intermediate institutions. It was the citizen and the state. And this really more what we came to think of as Marxist utopian, and when it's just all citizens, then they will have power. No, the state will have the power. But the idea that everything done by plebiscite, by citizens, and it wasn't family. I mean, the French Revolution, I don't know if you realize, that's where no-fault divorce was invented in the course of the French Revolution. And then they quickly had to dial that back because it was leading to abandoned children and abandoned women in drastic degrees. Then it was tried again in the Bolshevik Revolution, and then they dialed it back. It's fascinating, but it was invented there. The citizen without tight bonds to the family and the state. And I find that this sense of powerlessness among people is a great impediment to them even seeing how they can live in this world, not only how they can live their freedom in religion, but how they can be good, faithful people, how they can be active in the world, in their own families, in the community. I see it also in the academy, where, you know, the prestige of a particular degree now to particular students is most of their security. In your lifetime, most people's money is not coming from, like, you know, a piece of real estate that daddy left them, right? Your new property is your know-how and your degree for the vast majority of people. Universities, which are becoming more and more, I mean, look at the conversation we're having just this week, they are big players in the American cultural stage, and they can make or break a person's career trajectory by the prestige of their degree, the size of their research programs, the amount of money they have to give away. Here, students are feeling overwhelmed by the university. And you may have all kinds of varying degrees about the question of opinions of free speech and academic freedom, and all of those would be legit questions for universities as we have them today. But both in the area of the family and in the area particularly of young people in the academy, they feel powerless. And it is our job to help reconstitute these intermediate communities so that they feel, and this is particularly true of religious families and religious students, that they are not just victims, but they also can be agents. Okay. A third point, and this one's pretty brief because I do want to leave time for questions, is anti-materialism. I'll be very brief on this. You know, less dry cleaning, less mowing means more time to spend on things that matter. I rest my case. As a means to more important ends. There is so much work to do for which there is not enough hands. I have friends and family who have 5,000 square feet houses, and you want to say, well, it's really nice and it's a great place for the kids to run around, but you're going to be spending money and time on stuff that we all know just doesn't matter. And then the other thing, when I say it's his own blessing, it's fascinating to me, you know, how in a world where the New York Times has stories about how everybody admires Pope Francis for his anti-materialism, the thing you have to spend 5 minutes clicking to get rid of is an ad for Van Cleef & Arpels for a $100,000 watch while the New York Times is celebrating poverty. Right, I get it, ad revenues, but the world in a leader and in someone they're going to believe, wants someone who is not attached to material things. It is absolutely a necessity for, I think, credible leadership. People trust people whose values are people, not things. And I think making that manifest by our way of living in advance is a huge way of manifesting God. In fact, I like secondhand shopping. I like it a lot. But I also mention it to people because I want them to know that that anti-materialism is a value I espouse, because I think it's necessary for people to know that. And I got to look nice, but okay, this, you know, all secondhand, right? $15, $70 for the jacket I got in Paris. They overcharge secondhand. And I won't segue into Paris. We can pray for Paris. I'm sure you prayed for Paris this morning. It's overwhelming. My daughter just studied there and came back from there. Anyway, it can happen. It's shocking to think it can happen anywhere. I just think today, and especially as you get older, if you have not learned, if people look at you and say, oh my gosh, you're still materialistic, what's wrong with you? You know, I think the older that a person is, the less, even the less excuse they can have for it. Too little reason, too little reality. And I put, again, the French Revolution. Richard John Neuhaus wrote an essay in First Things years ago where he said, if the philosophers of the French Revolution woke up in the late 20th century, they would be floored at the fact that it was the Catholic Church defending reason. Who knew that we would be at the barricades defending reason? And we still are. I even have priest friends of mine who say that we're now not just post-reason, but post-reality. We won't even, and that's another way of saying we won't call things by their proper names. We know, for instance, what works for children's well-being in marriage and family. But somehow, the idea that we could say to adults, you know, take some responsibility for your sexual encounters, that's where children begin. We're like, we can't say that. Not in America. That's not acceptable. That's not freedom. Really? That's post-reality. It's post-reality to see the videos of Planned Parenthood and not use the word barbaric. And to just say, oh, Planned Parenthood defends women, it does this, it does that. That's just post-reality to overlook that. It's like stepping over a lot of dead bodies to go get a Coke out of a machine and saying nothing about it other than that Coke was a nice price. It was a dollar. That was a good price for a Coke and a machine. I mean, it's shocking. It's post-reality. With regard to reason, reason is not a silver bullet, though. It is not so convincing to a lot of people. I often think about an encounter I had with the editor of the Philadelphia Inquirer, and I had brought an embryology textbook from the University of Pennsylvania, which was very, very near her office, and was talking about Roe versus Wade, and everyone understands, medical textbooks understand, these are genetically unique human beings. And she says to me, oh, embryos are shed all the time in early pregnancy. You're making a big deal out of nothing. And she was sitting on the windowsill of her office, and I was sitting in the chair, and I said, do you mean if I pushed you out that window, that would be no morally different than if you slipped and fell? And then she says to me, I don't want your religious arguments in this office. That's post-reality. Okay? So reason doesn't always work, but over time, if you are always honest, if you always use good data, if you always make the modest conclusions the truth allows you to make, if you do not take cheap shots, you're not ad hominem, you don't tell a lie, you don't spend your time beating up on the other side, you say what is truthfully. There's a famous line from Walker Percy when abortion began to be more publicly accepted. He said, "It looks like you may win. That may be true that you'll win, but we're going to tell you what you're doing while it's happening." Isn't that a great line? We're going to tell you what you're doing. Just narrating back. And if you do that over time and become known as a person who is truthful and reasonable and treats other people well, over time, reason gathers some moss. Over time. There was an article about René Girard, a very famous French thinker who just died a couple of days ago. I used his article as the basis for one. He wrote one called Les Enfants du Désir, The Children of Desire, about the way we manufacture and luxury good children into being today. And there was a quote at the end of it, and a Stanford professor was quoted saying, "Listen, Girard really took the Christian stuff seriously, and so of course he was never really going to be taken seriously in the academy. But over time, he began to be respected." I cut that out, blew it up, and stuck it on my bulletin board at work because I thought that's exactly the fate of known Christian scholars. But over time, reason gathers moss. Okay. The next thing, a recommendation, new language. I believe, and I'm going to have to start to be a little quicker here, that there is great illiteracy in the usual language that we use in the world. I wrote an article for Crux, and I actually had the temerity to send it over to the Synod Fathers from the United States and say, "Could you think about this while the Synod's going on, please?" And it was called, "Dear Synod Fathers, You Missed a Step." And what I said in part was that the language of Holy Trinity, Holy Family, domestic church is over as far as most people know it. George Weigel's great line, "Religion by osmosis is done." We have to relate to people where they are. We have to start with their presence. And so I had to give a talk at Princeton to the Love and Fidelity Network a few weeks ago, and I had to even start talking to them about why women and men would find each other different but attractive. And I told ridiculous stories about how I found my husband attractive wearing gross fishing clothes with an open truck with fish guts all over it, smoking a cigar with a backwards hat and an espresso, teaching my kids to fish in slimy rocks down by the bay. And I was like, and I thought to myself, before I got married, I would have had all kinds of theoretical reasons about why men are fools. And now I'm like, that is just so cool. I can't even explain why. But let me try and explain it to you. We end up having to explain these basic things from them. And where do I think we're going to get some of this new language? I've tried it out. I tried it at Wide World Reading Speech. I tried it at Love and Fidelity Network. I'll be trying it out for a couple of years now. I think Laudato Si's language about what is natural and what God has made, what creation looks like, is one. I think data that also tells a human story. Neil Postman, the famous sociologist who talked about how sociologists collect numbers, but if you put it together and you say, you know, this tells a story, and the story is credible, that makes a big impression. Not data alone, but data plus a story. So what do we find? Women are not depressed before uncommitted sexual encounters, but women who had no history of depression suffer more depression after it. Huh, what's the story there? The story about who women are anthropologically in connection with sex, what it means to them. I think global choices, which is another way of saying natural law. I participated in putting together the Humanum Project, and we have these films about people from 14 religions in all these countries talking about mother, father, sex, male, female, child, disabled child, elderly relatives, marital difficulties, just in those terms. You didn't hear domestic church, Trinity, Holy Family. You get to that when people are ready, but there's so much pre-evangelization that has to be done. I got to be really quick here. New leadership. I think authoritative is in, authoritarian is out. Oh, no time for fear, I skipped it. When I watched the Synod and I read the world's reaction to it, because I was commenting here and there and interacting with this or that Synod father, you realize nobody believes the bishops because they're bishops anymore. Because they're bishops. It's not enough to say, I'm a bishop and therefore. And it's probably not enough, although I actually suspect sisters get a little bit more cred in advance. I'm just guessing that they get a little bit more credibility in advance. Right? the bishops have, I'm not making an argument about whether it's true or false, but they're perceived as authoritarian. Just like fathers in families were perceived as authoritarian. And if you look at all the literature on families, it says authoritative, confident, knowledgeable. A good authority figure, right, is a servant to the people he serves, like a parent is a servant to children. We all know this, right? Authoritative, not authoritarian, is a way. So when I am confident about my faith, but not triumphalistic, when I am in love with it, but willing to say that it stumbles, right? That's being, I think, authoritative. Just the way with my child, I would say, I had this, maybe not quote this for public, but I'm just going to say it. Like, I have this son who's just wildly artistically gifted, and he was leaping from one thing to another. And one day I was just blowing up because he wouldn't study, and he was going to the sixth musical instrument and the fourth artistic medium. And I said, "You're an inch deep." And I thought, okay, that was really mean. And yet, in one way, 3 days later, when he was speaking to me again, he said, "What should I focus on? I understand. I'm good at nothing. I need to start with something." Right? But I apologized. I said, "I think what I said was true, but I said it cruelly." And so, da 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 da, right? I still have my authority, because if you can't recognize when you're wrong and mean, then you don't have any authority. Today, the credible, integrated, loving, egalitarian leader, in other words, the Jesus figure, is the leader. And I mean, Pope Francis is exhibits A to exhibit Z. The credibility of living without a lot of stuff, being open to all sorts of people, and treating them person a person as a person of great worth. Loving witness, self-denial, that's mysterious but not irrational. It's mysterious because the culture best understands itself as moving towards self-aggrandizement, as gaining, as always gaining in something, progress in something that the world can measure. And your sacrifice, or a parent's, or a teacher's, or is mysterious to them still. But not all that is mysterious is irrational. And they come to understand as they see you live it out over time. As I come to visit the nuns, the two nuns who taught me in high school, one died at 99 recently, one died at 100, right on her 100th birthday, well, the week of it. You see its fruits. So it's mysterious, but I see it's not irrational. And people see it in families as well. People first, I've already explained that as non-material. Obviously, giving every person that look of love they crave, stopping to give attention and time. The final thought I have, no time for fear. This is one of my favorite points. I used to say, now she's not so much on the scene anymore, if you don't, Oprah will. I don't know, who would I substitute for that now? If you don't, Stephen Colbert will. If you don't, who else? Obama will. If you don't, the girl Lena Dunham, who runs Girls, will. If you don't, Gloria Steinem, for some strange reason, still will. Okay? Most people in the world are not, they're not as frightening to speak to, or to try and persuade, or even confront with a wrong opinion as you think they are. Most people are not loaded for bear with every argument and reason and data point and thought under the sun. Most people want to be approached and looked at and loved. It's why my students who disagree with me most robustly on issues like marriage and stuff always end up in my office chatting with me and become my friends, right? You have to discern what your talent is, how you were called. I've explained sort of how I sort of like, I leap and then I look back and I go, oh, okay, well that leap was okay, and that one wasn't. Whatever your method is, whatever God's method is with you, the need for what you are doing is so gargantuan that there is no time for fear on this. And it doesn't mean you don't have to work really, really hard. I like to say to my law students, and
I'm not sure this is healthy, but I do believe it's true, that they have this misbegotten idea that life is a lot of pleasant times interrupted by hard work. But actually, life is hard work with some leisure. The leisure is great, but life, you know, don't... The Neanderthal and the early, you know, agricultural American had it right. Life is mostly working to do good things, but the work is beautiful. The work is great. As John Paul II used to say, it has this great value because you're doing it. But if you don't do it, and if you don't say the things that need to be said and work hard to figure out how to say them, as well as why they're true and how you can explain yourself, Oprah will say them, and she'll get it wrong. So thank you very much. I'm going to stop.